Warning to our listeners. This is a highly sensitive episode as the subject matter revolves around people with profound eating disorders, as well as the topic of suicide. This episode may be upsetting to those with a history of, or currently struggling with an eating disorder, or other mental health illnesses. If you or someone you know is struggling with an eating disorder and needs support, please call the National Eating Disorders Association at 800-931-2237 or visit www.nationaleatingdisorders.org. Finally, if needed, please call the Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. For free and confidential support. Hi, friends. Dr. Jennifer Gaudiani is a medical internist who specializes in treating people with eating disorders. Known as Dr. G amongst her patients, she operates one of the largest outpatient organizations in the country, providing services to people with eating disorders. Licensed in 32 states, Dr. G has a massive practice in which she positively impacts the lives of people all over the country. In this episode, Dr. G joins us to discuss her recent case study in which she had given the medical aid in dying prescription to three of her patients, the family responses, and the overall outcome of the study, which ultimately leads to the ethical dilemma of providing MAID to those with a mental health illness. Thank you, Dr. G, for taking the time to talk with us and to help shed light on what is undoubtedly a critical subject. All right, cool. Well, we're here with Dr. Jennifer Gaudiani. I believe I said that correctly.
Yeah, you got it.
Gaudiani. Yeah, Dr. G, as I recognized in one of your papers, is what some of your patients call you. So if that's okay, I'll stick with Dr. G. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. We're here with the Death with Dignity podcast, and we're really excited to have you on. You are bringing a totally different perspective and approach to the idea of medical aid in dying. And that's why we were so curious to talk to you. We'd like to hear about your practices and how you support people in your field, which is a little different from, I guess, our usual guests. As you mentioned, you've listened to a few episodes. We typically have people on who are doctors, maybe supporting others with cancer or ALS or a terminal diagnosis. Whereas you're a doctor who supports people with eating disorders primarily. Before we really dive in, though, I always love to give the chance to for our guests to just tell us a little bit about themselves, maybe some personal stuff if you'd like to share. There's so much more to our lives than just our work and our practice, and I think that we need to really recognize that. And yeah, fill us in. Anything you want to share, hobbies? We know you're in Colorado, so what a great place to be. Maybe some mountain exploring. What are you into out there, and how'd you end up there as well?
Yeah, I would love to. Thanks. Let's see. I am an internist who specializes in eating disorders. My husband and I met in college and came out here after we finished all of our training because we thought that Colorado would be a great type B setting in which to mellow out our slightly more type A personalities. And that's worked to some extent, I think. We absolutely adore it here. We love the outdoors. I am mom of two really badass teenage girls. They're 13 and 16, and I continue to enjoy being their parent ever more the older that they get. They are so much fun and are radically better skiers than I am. And that was always the goal. So yeah, we love the outdoors. I'm a huge fantasy fiction nerd and just sort of generally a big nerd overall. So, you know, I love my work. I absolutely love recharging with friends and enjoy the outdoors.
That's awesome. Yeah. What a great place to be, Colorado. mountain air, all the good stuff. And like you said, lots of opportunity to kind of disconnect and relax a little bit. So thank you for sharing some of that info. And anything along the way that you want to share, please feel free to fill us in. Will you tell us a little bit about your educational background? Did you go to school in Colorado, or did you go to school elsewhere?
I'd love to share it with you. So I grew up in Northern California, the oldest of three girls. And I went to Harvard undergrad and was an English major and a pre-med. Got into one medical school out of the 26 I applied to, and went to Boston University with gratitude, and then went to Yale for my internal medicine residency and chief year. So I have all these fancy credentials behind me, which is all to say I really enjoyed my schooling and was very grateful for it. And I decided to do internal medicine because, again, super nerd. I just want to be involved in all of the pieces of people's lives and see them as whole people. And came out to Colorado shortly after I finished my training, and kind of by accident, fortunate accident, ended up getting to grow and run the nation's top medical stabilization program for adults with critical anorexia nervosa who were too medically compromised to receive care anywhere else. And my sister had an eating disorder and has been very generous in allowing me to share that she's my inspiration. She has recovered. And without a question, really from day one, I fell in love with this patient population. They were varied, of course, but this is a group of individuals who is so smart and sensitive, thoughtful, hardworking, insightful, and aware of the world. I just adore them. And then they have these tormenting diseases, and they have a lot of medical problems that happen. Because it turns out that when you don't nourish yourself consistently, or when you purge your food, bad things happen. So I really fell in love with this group, and I just sort of accidentally fell into it, in the sense that there's a lot of great dietitians and therapists who specialize in eating disorders, but very, very few medical doctors. This population is viewed with resistance and fear by the medical community. Unfortunately, they're sort of viewed as being too difficult. So even psychiatrists often will specifically say, I don't take patients with eating disorders, much less medical doctors or family practitioners, internists like me, who are here to really help with what happens in the body. So what I found was there was this lovely unexpected niche for me to develop my own voice within the field, not only to do better diagnosis and treatment of both the measurable and unmeasurable medical complications people with eating disorders get, but also particularly as I transitioned into my outpatient clinic in 2016, where I see people from all over the country, every age, gender, body shape, and size, to really bring a perspective that's centered in honoring patient autonomy, body consent, awareness of the systemic oppression of diet culture and the influence of the medical system on people, unfortunately, in a negative way, in almost every possible body size out there, but particularly people in larger bodies. So I love to bring that interplay and perspective. I'm very social justice oriented, and I'm what's called a weight inclusive provider, in that I never focus on weight loss. I never encourage it. Really, it's sort of every body that comes in is good unto itself. And my role is to help people get better to attain the goals they say are important.
Wow, that's impressive. A lot to unpack. And I admire your attitude and compassion. It's obvious that you're doing what you can to support these individuals. Tell us a little bit about what exactly anorexia nervosa is and what it might entail for an individual. As we mentioned, the primary focus of this podcast has generally been geared towards people with a terminal illness such as cancer or maybe ALS or something. So this is a new stuff to our listeners. I'm sure there are people out there who've heard of the term, maybe you've experienced it themselves or had a family member who has been involved or had this illness as well. But just tell us a little bit about what it entails.
Absolutely. Let me just start so that anybody who themselves may be in the throes of an eating disorder have a loved one just by this important little disclaimer, which is that the vast majority of people with eating disorders do not occupy emaciated bodies. The vast, vast majority, the sort of stereotype of a young, thin, white, well-to-do woman as being the poster child for eating disorders turns out to be entirely false. That particular type of patient has often gotten a lot of the most attention in the eating disorder field, but by no means does that individual represent people with eating disorders. That said, we're going to focus on anorexia nervosa in this podcast because that is the diagnosis that pertains to the very, very few patients that I have had the unbelievable privilege to care for who haven't been able to survive this mental illness that has a medical cause of death. So anorexia nervosa is a mental illness as defined by the DSM-5, which diagnoses all mental illnesses. It's characterized by distortion of body image and believing oneself to be larger than they are, a fear of fatness and of gaining weight, which ultimately results in a fear of either all food or certain types of foods or a certain number of calories, and an emaciated body. Those are sort of the key features of anorexia nervosa. It is thought to have a prevalence of about 0.1%. So it's relatively rare, but it's a big population. And there's a lot of people with anorexia nervosa, both in the United States and around the world. It has a female to male prevalence typically of around 9 to 1, although there has been a surge of anorexia nervosa in boys and men as society continues to put people through outrageous sort of goals of how they should look and what health and wellness and a good body should be. And most importantly, perhaps, to this discussion, anorexia nervosa carries the second highest death rate of any mental illness, only second to opioid use disorder. It is estimated that 5 to up to 20% of people diagnosed with anorexia nervosa will perish from complications of it or from suicide because it is an intolerably cruel mental illness where the eating disorder voice constantly taunts the individual by saying, you aren't enough, you ate too much, you're lazy, you should do more, you're not sick enough to get help, and is truly a torment that's present at all times. So my entire career has been dedicated to saving the lives of people with anorexia nervosa. And having been the medical director of my prior hospital program, I have seen the most medically compromised people in the entire country and gotten to know them closely and adore them. And practically everybody can survive, even when they get to a near-death place of malnutrition, if they have the right treatment. So I've seen the most medically compromised. And in my clinical practice outpatient, I've seen every other possible variant of anorexia that there is, really for the last 14 years. So I've had a lot of experience with that. And my goal is to find any way possible through helpful medical work and just through knowing the illness and working in a multidisciplinary fashion to help people get better. Hopefully all the way better, because we feel that everyone with anorexia nervosa should have the opportunity to get fully, completely recovered, which is possible. And also for those who can't get all the way better, to work towards a harm reduction place, some place where there's an uneasy balance between the person being able to honor their goals and values, but not triggering the eating disorder so much that the whole house of cards comes down. So my career has been dedicated, and it's very important everyone understand this, because the idea that a mental illness could be deadly can be tough. My whole career has been dedicated to healing and ameliorating. And that does not exclude the possibility that some can't get better. And that's what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, exactly. Beautiful description and information. And it's obvious that you have a vast amount of experience with these people. And we're talking from, I'm sure, success stories, which I'd love to hear about at some point during our discussion, as well as people who are victims of this disease. I did find that staggering when reading your study about how it is the second leading cause next to opioid abuse. That was really astounding to me. One of the questions that, or I guess drawing from my own experience as a special education teacher, one of the components I recognized and learned about was the idea of self-determination and really just autonomy and being in charge of yourself, decision-making, taking action in your own life. And I wanted to ask about these patients and this idea of basically trying to maintain this disease. For example, you mentioned having that balance of maybe like maintaining the disease while trying to live a productive and healthy life. So it seems like there's at times there is recognition within these people. They recognize that they have an eating disorder. Would you say that this is a benefit for them, having that recognition and I guess pathway to success or getting healthier? Or is there not really much correlation between that and healthiness?
That's a wonderful question. And the theme of self-determination, of body autonomy, of being able to make choices for one's body are absolutely richly woven into this whole story. So almost every person with an eating disorder, and very particularly for those with anorexia nervosa, there's a sense that the denial of disease severity or that bad things could happen is really woven in, which is why it's a mental illness. You know, it's not somebody that's sort of choosing to eat less or to live in a smaller body. This is a mental illness that gets its talons in, and it can be very, very, very hard to shake. So it's almost universal. Even in the patients that I took care of in my hospital days, where by definition they were the most medically compromised of them all, for them to say at some point in our interactions, our first interactions, Dr. G, I'm ashamed to be here. I don't think I'm sick enough. And that's the reason that when I wrote a book, I called it Sick Enough, A Guide to the Medical Complications of Eating Disorders. Because in the mental illness is this sense, I'm not that bad. I'm probably fine. I don't even know I am here. And it's one of the ways the eating disorder sustains itself. It's looking to stay active. So a very important and interesting distinction, for instance, from those who have cancer, is that anorexia nervosa is what's called an egocentric disease. People strive to keep it. They don't want to get rid of it. It feels like an important, powerful, necessary part of themselves, which no one with cancer has ever said. However, the treatment for anorexia can be excruciating. And, you know, whether that's in the outpatient setting and you're taking time out of your school or job or life to meet with a doctor and a therapist and a dietitian who are asking you to do things that feel like anathema, which is to rest more, nourish consistently, allow your body weight to come back up to where it needs to be. For many people, those sound like relaxing, joyful tasks. But for those with anorexia nervosa, it's torture. Not to mention those who cannot make improvements in the outpatient setting and who need often at great personal and time expense to spend time in a higher level of care, a residential program, a full day treatment program, a hospital. Those stays can last from weeks to months while the work is done. That is incredibly disruptive to a life, and yet it's life-saving. So every patient and family will fight and do whatever they can to gain access to attempt full recovery. And I'll just say that I have seen patients of every age, disease, duration, number of relapses, and severity achieve full recovery. And we have to recognize that the act of going through this treatment, the number of times that patients' families have remortgaged homes to pay for the 7th, 8th, and 9th stay, the schooling and graduation that's lost, the births and weddings that they don't get to witness, the relationships they never get to engage in because they've been completely engaged with their eating disorder and out of the flow of their peers. It is deeply burdensome. And it occurs within a system of treatment that, while it's the best we've got, and the US probably does the best with this kind of higher level of care treatment of any country, is still deeply traumatic for many people. And it's incredibly autonomy removing. You have to finish this meal, or we're going to put a tube in your nose and give you the calories anyway. Even just being this hypersensitive, sweet being who is crushed with a sense of not being sick enough and feeling competitive with everybody else, being plopped into a program where everyone else feels the same. I mean, patients talk about learning tips and tricks to become a better anorexic in the very settings that are meant to be helpful. So treatment is necessary. It is very often successful, and it is unbelievably challenging and flawed.
Yeah, I, from reading the article that you had written, the case study involving the three patients, one of the things that stood out was the severity of, for example, Aaron was one of the individuals involved. And towards the end of his experience as a person, as a human, and someone with anorexia, he described fears of even putting on lip balm, being afraid that that would cause him to ingest calories. Smelling food in a kitchen may cause ingestion of calories, even though we know that this is not possible, right? And this is somebody who is, judging by reading his background, a very intelligent individual. So I guess my question is this disease almost like a differently wired brain, for lack of a better way of describing it? Is it just that for whatever reason these people have, and maybe it's changed over time through the malnourishment of battling with this disease? I don't know. Maybe it's from the start of their development. And I wanted to ask as well, could it be societal pressures causing these these problems? So could you speak a little bit to what could be the ultimate cause? Is it a physical thing inside the brain versus some of the pressures of our society?
That's really insightful. The answer is that the debate rages on. What I have come to understand through being in the field and through all of the research that I've read and the patients that I've seen, the best way I can put it is there's probably a genetic predisposition to a risk for getting anorexia. And I don't mean sort of one gene. There are groups that have done brilliant work at looking at sort of genetic risk points, but we're not talking about an anorexia gene. We're talking about the genetics that one inherits from biological parents that tend to make individuals who are at risk be among the most intelligent, sensitive, harm avoidant, anxious, perfectionistic, and driven people you can imagine. And a lot of those traits are really productive. But when you have enough of them at the far end of the bell curve of how they show up, and then you plunk that person into a society that is constantly giving perfectionistic messages and fat stigmatizing messages about how thinness is best, and how everyone is constantly talking obsessively about eating healthy, quote unquote, and cutting this or that out. The patient with those traits, who is exquisitely sensitive to the inputs of the world and feels more wounded and fearful of them than the average person, can easily turn to soothing themselves through restricting food. Most people, when they're hungry, feel uncomfortable and cranky and seek food. But these individuals feel a sense of calm, protection from the world. They can feel like this numbs the emotions that feel so overwhelming. And it becomes a coping strategy. And then all of that with a starved brain on top sort of creates the perfect storm, because starved brains, we know from a variety of very interesting studies, become really weird about food and about body image, even when someone doesn't have an eating disorder. Biologically, brains change when they get starved. So the whole the theory behind eating disorder, anorexia recovery, is how can we get this individual who's highly resistant to taking care of themselves refed to the point where their brain is fully nourished and they have fewer of the distortions that come just from starvation alone, and then do therapy and try medication to help fix the way that the brain is functioning and soothing itself and engaging with the world. There aren't any medicines specifically for anorexia. Some can take the edge off comorbid depression, anxiety, OCD, insomnia, but there aren't any medicines, and there aren't any perfect therapeutic strategies that work for the preponderance of patients. It's usually a number of different ones that hopefully help someone gain skills to tolerate life. What gets really complicated with regards to the theme of self-determination is that these are individuals, unlike someone, for instance, with schizophrenia, who's floridly psychotic and who cannot connect with reality almost at all, who in 98% of the parts of their lives are the smartest person you've ever met. They are the straight A student, the best athletic team member, the most diligent daughter, the most organized son, and they are brilliantly successful, except in this little narrow part when it comes to food and body. So when we think about self-determination, of which I am a great proponent, it can be tough for people to think, Dr. G, how can you possibly even talk about body autonomy in people who are fundamentally unable to see their bodies with clarity? Where does that even live? How can they make decisions for themselves? And my answer to that, which, you know, I think only very experienced eating disorder clinicians can really be thinking about, patients who finally say, I can't fight anymore. Not I want to die. They want to live without the torment, but despite seeking it in every possible way, the torment won't go. So when those patients say, I can't fight anymore, and I'm so terribly sorry that I'm going to miss out on the rest of a life given all of the gifts I have, but I can't bear this anymore. That's when there are very much two schools of thought. One school of thought is you have to keep forcing these patients to go back into treatment. There can never be a no. There must be some final treatment at a certain stage of their life when it finally clicks and they'll get better. Because they do have this narrowly defined mental illness. What my perspective is, though, that this is still a whole person. And we can talk about how the article came to be, but in the final analysis, if this is a grown-up who has anorexia nervosa, who has tried everything they have access to get better many, many times over the years, and finally says, I can't fight anymore, if they can understand the options and the implications of what they choose, they have a right to make decisions for their own bodies. They don't have to make good decisions. They don't have to make a decision we would agree with. But that's not the standard to which we hold decision-making. We don't say in the hospital, if someone wants to leave against medical advice with a raging infection, oh no, you're not allowed to make your own decisions because you're making a bad choice. We say, do you understand the ramifications of what you're choosing? Do you understand the options you have? Okay, then you're allowed to choose for your body.
Yeah, thank you for that explanation. Certainly a ton to unpack there. I had lots of questions kind of developing as you were speaking. Can you tell us a little bit more about how you think society might impact some of these disorders? And I also wanted to ask, do you think that this idea and something like medical aid in dying is setting a precedent for other people with anorexia nervosa? For example, is this in a way planting the seed, even at a subconscious level? And yeah, I guess we'll go from there. So maybe it's society impacts and then what you think about how this might be setting some kind of precedent.
Great. Society 100% impacts people in the development and sustenance of their eating disorder. We live in a diet culture society in which my patients are often stopped on the street or in the mall by someone who says, "Wow, you look great. What, you must be so healthy. What's your secret?" And this is somebody who is profoundly depressed and is in organ failure from anorexia. So the mistaken vision that if you look the part, you are the part, is very deeply confused and very harmful in our society. I think before I answer the question of do my theories of these patients potentially cause harm, I'd love to just give your listeners a quick history of what this article is. Like, what are we talking about?
Yeah, Let's back up a little bit.
Because I want to get to that. It's a very important question to answer. The situation is that several years ago, I met a brilliant young man who had just finished almost a year of state mandated treatment for anorexia nervosa against his will in a very high quality eating disorder treatment program here in Colorado. He had fully weight restored with enormous effort. And he was in his 30s and had been sick with anorexia since he was in his young adolescence. He had tried a million programs before. And given his degree of illness, when he relapsed, he would get so medically unstable so fast. And then there would be a real brouhaha trying to get him into treatment and you know, encourage him, force him, require him, all of this stuff. That I said to him when he came to do an initial consultation with me as he was starting to think about transitioning out of this program, I said, if, as I hope, when you go home, you are able to find some ground on which you can maintain health and live your life, I will be there with bells on to support you in every way I have and to encourage you. If, however, you relapse in the way you have done many times before, and you don't choose to go back to treatment, then I'm going to support you in a palliative and then hospice setting, perspective, focus, because you will die of your anorexia. You know, starvation will eventually lead to death medically. So it's a mental illness, but it's a medical cause of death. And he said, you know, well, that just seems a little bit too stark and binary. And he completed the rest of his treatment for a couple of months and came back to me. And he said, okay, I'm ready to go home. And he said, I guess I'll join your clinic and you can be my doctor, but I'm not really sure what I'm going to choose for myself yet. I don't know what I'll choose. As it happened, and this is so rare that he's the only one I've ever seen this in, from the day he left treatment, he did not eat another bite of food until he died naturally of the medical complications of malnutrition 10 and a half weeks later. He only drank water. And I supported him and his parents, who are just dazzlingly wonderful people. And he had a wonderful hospice experience where, as he developed pain and nausea and anxiety, and they gave him medications to help him. And eventually he passed away with his family around him. And while they deeply, deeply grieved and still grieve his loss, their chance to reconnect with him without the pressure of you have to go back to treatment, but to really connect with him as their son, as their brother, was so meaningful to them. And a couple of years later, I began caring for a young woman who had been through the ringer many, many, many times, had severe anorexia nervosa, a brilliant professional, an incredible young woman. And she too was trying to find a harm reduction place where she could tolerate it. And as my care with her was proceeding, I began to see another young woman who had a similar perspective, had a similar situation, sick for so long and had tried so many things. And the second woman ultimately said to me, "Dr. G, I can't do this anymore. I can't fight. I'm tormented every day. Nothing, no amount of low weight satisfies my anorexia. I can't do this." And I thought to myself about an individual that I had taken care of in my hospital program previously, who was in her mid-30s, similar story. She had come to my hospital program many, many times and had tried treatment, fully weight restored. And she finally said, "I can't do it anymore." So I had conversations with her about what does this look like, what might happen next. I've always been passionate about end-of-life care ever since medical school, and frequently would engage in the end-of-life conversations that were taking care in the intensive care unit or on the medical wards in my subsequent internal medicine career. And so I'm very comfortable with these conversations. And I spoke with her parents. We had a formal decision-making capacity done by a psychiatrist to be sure she was really able to understand what was going on. She certainly was. And so we sent her home in hopes that, you know, she would be able to get hospice care with her primary care doctor and she would have a supported end. Instead, in her home state, her primary care doctor fired her because he said, "Anorexia can't be a terminal illness. You just have to eat." And then she was alone. No therapist or dietitian would see her because she wasn't on a recovery pathway and she was clearly so ill. And even though I called and begged, no hospice organization would accept that anorexia could be terminal either, and they wouldn't see her. And so while I won't say any weight numbers so as not to trigger anyone listening to this, she wrote me a month or two, three maybe later, and said, "Dr. G, my weight has gotten down to fill in a lower number than you can imagine a human being surviving at. My life is terrible. I am in excruciating pain. I'm totally dependent upon my parents for my activities of daily living. Will you take me back to the hospital?" I said, "Of course, we'll get a life flight. We'll get you here as soon as possible." And she wrote me back the next day and she said, "It's just that I feel so terrible. I still don't feel I can recover, so I'm not going to come." She survived a month more before she died. This was not a good death. It was a travesty because young people can hold on a remarkably long time from malnutrition when they have no other underlying medical complication. And so as my second patient here in the outpatient setting was talking about death, she brought up to me, "What if I could use medical aid and dying medications?" And they were legal in her state. And I said, "Yeah, that seems extremely reasonable to me because you have a terminal illness. You clearly have an expected length of life that's less than 6 months from your malnutrition. And now that we know you will perish, it is absolutely appropriate to use these medications, which allow a patient to choose the when and where, because it's going to happen." And so I acted in the role of the consulting physician. There have to be two doctors. And she found a wonderful local palliative care doctor who was very prominent in the community. And he and I talked and he read her records and he said, "Yeah, this is a woman who's dying. She has depression, but it is not impacting her ability to make this choice," which is the way that the law is written. And so he prescribed her MAID and she held it for several months, during which her parents reflect that they had her for longer than they would have otherwise, because she knew when the suffering got too terrible, she would not have to die by suicide, that she would have a way to leave the planet in a comfortable manner. And she died by MAID with her family around her in a very loving manner. And at the same time, I'm taking care of this third patient who used to be a researcher herself and is thinking now, she's tried everything, she can't keep going. again, these are three out of my practice of hundreds over the last 6 years, much less my entire career in eating disorders. And her family says, where's the literature? Where's the literature on terminal anorexia? I said, there isn't any. They said, how can that be that a disease with the second highest death rate of any mental illness, and there's no literature on who's going to die or how we treat them, how we talk to them? There had been some wonderful literature on, you know, palliative care and anorexia written by, among others, this brilliant psychiatrist who's also in Colorado, Dr. Joel Yeager. And so I said to her, I think based on the last two patients I've cared for in this situation and you, I need to write a paper about this where I detail your case studies. Would you like to be a posthumous author on this paper with me? Do you want to have your voice heard formally? And she said, absolutely. So she wrote me these brilliant, beautiful, thought-provoking words that do appear in the paper. And we asked Dr. Yeager to join this paper, which he did. She then said, since I'm going to die of malnutrition, I too would like to have the option for MAID, because I don't want to have my parents see me die in some tragic way. And I don't want to linger forever when the time comes. And so we were in a bit of a pickle because her local palliative doctor, who was wonderful, didn't really feel comfortable prescribing MAID for a 35-year-old with severe terminal malnutrition from anorexia. He understood that she had a terminal illness, but it didn't quite sit right, which was absolutely his right. We had an ethics committee meeting about this, and they said, you know, look, there's just not enough literature on this. If this disease is terminal, then she deserves to have a right to MAID, and it's okay for this other doctor not to prescribe. So her primary care doctor ended up performing the role of a consulting physician. And after consulting with the board of medicine in her state, which I'm licensed in, I determined that I was able to be the prescribing physician, and I prescribed her MAID. However, she died of natural causes of her anorexia 3 days before she planned to take it. And so I wrote the paper with Dr. Yeager and used Alyssa's words. Each of the families asked their children's first names be used, not pseudonyms and not initials, because they wanted those reading it to feel the humanity of the people involved, to recognize that even though not every patient, not all of the three, had done every single thing I would have liked, let's try ketamine. Let's try psilocybin. How can we help your mood? Let's try full weight restoration, which is always the preferred standard first, to see how your well-nourished brain goes. But none of these individuals would accept more treatment. They were done. So there were two options: abandonment or loving support with a focus on their comfort and dignity. And I chose the latter. And we proposed for the first time, what are the clinical characteristics of someone with terminal anorexia? Not like we know everything. Goodness knows, I'm learning all the time. But just to say, in the eating disorder community, we have to start talking about this. Because clinicians can say, no one should ever die of an eating disorder. We can never say that someone has terminal anorexia. That's outrageous. Is like saying, as they do at the dinners and the rallies, no one should ever die of breast cancer again. That's true. No one should. We should make the science better and fix it. But to take that statement and then say, therefore, we should never provide hospice care for people whose breast cancer is terminal, is of course outrageous. It ignores the reality. And so in writing the paper, the question came up, only one of the three patients actually perished through the use of MAID. The other two died of the natural consequences of their eating disorder. And so two questions came up. Is there such a thing as terminal anorexia? Which clearly I hold that there is, because I've seen these patients and cared for them. And then secondarily, should someone with a terminal disease that has got a mental origin be allowed to have medical aid in dying? And what effect could that permission have on others who also feel that they are despairing, that they have worked so hard, that things haven't worked? Are they going to view this, per your question now, as an easy way out? And the answer is absolutely not. Because anyone who gets so despairing that they want an easy way out, if we're speaking frankly, has the option to die by suicide. I mean, it's always out there. That is, if we want to say it, the way off the planet. The work to get somebody into relationship with a highly experienced eating disorder provider. I knew these patients for Aaron Parrish the earliest because of his unique circumstances. The other two I knew for over a year. This was a deep relationship. I knew their family members. I had had meetings with them all. We had had hours upon hours of conversations. We had tried alternatives and we had tried to make life work. This is a long, long dialogue and dance. And at the very end, they were going to perish, and therefore they should be afforded the comfortable and dignified end, if they chose it, of using MAID. And so I would say that naming that a disease may have a terminal version does not make people die. It speaks what already exists. It gives it a name, and it validates the lived experience of family members who have had loved ones die of this and of individuals.
Thank you for the thought out answer. A lot to unpack for sure. One of the things that I, and you brought it up as well, was that the patients in your study did not seek and complete all courses of treatment. For example, the use of psilocybin, which is something I talk about several times throughout the podcast, or magic mushrooms, if you will. Another piece, one patient had not completed a full residential treatment. As a stage four cancer patient, as well as someone who has access to medical aid and dying, I remember when I had been diagnosed, and this was before the terminal diagnosis, I looked in the mirror and I said to myself, I'll do anything possible to get healthy and to get rid of this disease. And since that time, I really have done anything possible. And unfortunately, I will not be able to beat this disease. One of the patterns I've noticed from this podcast is that all the patients I've talked to who have a terminal disease like cancer have such a strong desire and will to live. It's just that we have been forced into a situation in which that won't be an option at some point. We know we will succumb to this disease. I have a hard time believing that the patients in the study did have that strong desire to live, especially considering they all had suicidal ideation at some point or suicidal tendencies. They all had what seemed like depression or some sort of form of depression. And my question is, how can you accurately assess that their use of this medication, or in the one case, the one person who used it, the other two did die naturally. How can you be sure that their use of this medication was to end their suffering versus suicide or an attempt to die in that sense?
Yeah, it's a beautiful question, and it absolutely gets to the heart of the complexity. This is not a tweetable subject. It requires a really long, thoughtful conversation with an expert like you to try to begin to unpack the complexities. So one of the themes that I'm really interested in is whether the suffering of a medical illness is congruent with the suffering of a mental illness. Historically in society and in Western medicine, we say that which is measurable, which is more typically a medical problem, is more real or more objective than the suffering of a mental illness that can't be measured. I don't think that's correct. Anyone listening who's had a mental illness before, or a loved one who's had a severe mental illness, knows that the suffering can be extraordinary. That's one piece to hold on to as we think about this. Another piece to hold on to is that each one of these patients wanted to live. They passionately wanted to be alive and to use their extraordinary gifts for the good of others. But even as those with cancer have a process in their body that inexorably grows despite every effort, so some individuals with anorexia have an inexorable process in their brains, unmeasurable, that makes life intolerable. It can be very hard for someone who's not had a loved one with an eating disorder to imagine how this can be so. That a disease where you so-called just have to eat, which is most people's joy, that ain't like many people's chemo, clearly, that this could be the issue. It's not, though, that their bodies couldn't be renourished. If you sedated them, put them in a coma, put a tube feed in them, and fed them for several months, their bodies have the capacity to become nourished. However, the brain processes in these few patients, thankfully not remotely the majority, stay malignantly horrific and intolerable. And so when you combine that level of suffering with a biological process that will kill them medically through the malnutrition, then you come to a point where you say, if I stand by an ideological framework here, you know, in each one of these patients, I worked, so Aaron had done everything. Aaron had done absolutely everything by the book. He had been in all the treatments, fully weight restored, tried everything, and couldn't survive. The other two, one of them had tried multiple admissions to different programs, and they were so intolerable to her that she had to leave. So she physically couldn't stay in a place that could get her body renourished, which might give her brain a chance to feel better. And they couldn't accept, because it's their right, in the same way that someone with cancer is not required to accept an untested, unproven experimental treatment, they couldn't accept some of the treatments that I love to use with patients to try to ameliorate their psychological suffering, like ketamine, et cetera. So at the point at which they're going to die of medical cause and their suffering is so extraordinary, it's not really mine to judge whether they've wanted life enough or checked every single box perfectly, because this isn't a textbook. It's a life. It's a human who finds life intolerable. And so my job then is not to be judge, but rather, having felt that I've used every ounce of my expertise to try to make life sustainable for this human, I then accept their final determination that they can no longer fight.
It's very hard for me and difficult to wrap my head around all of this, obviously. And I think part of that is because I don't have the experience like you do with people with eating disorders. And I'm sure for our listeners, some of this is going to be very powerful and impactful. The severity of these things is as hardcore as it gets. My question, especially as an educator, a special education teacher, one of the things I learned early on in my career was the idea of people first language. And I learned how language is a very important part of obviously dialogue and respect for individuals. For example, rather than saying, he's autistic, you would say that's a man with autism, right? Identifying the person before the disability. And it sounds like there are similar practices within your field as well as other fields. For example, I've noticed a trend regarding suicide. We don't say they committed suicide. It is now they died by suicide.
Correct.
My question regarding this topic is, in regards to medical aid in dying, do you think that there is a difference between medical aid in dying versus something like physician-assisted suicide? Is there a difference between those two, I guess, those words and definitions?
Oh, 100%. 100%. And I feel that your past guest, whom I just loved listening to, just remember Dr. Kligler from Massachusetts, who spoke so beautifully on medical aid in dying, pointed out that it is not the physician causing the death. The disease causes the death. As the two patients who died of natural causes show, they were going to die of medical malnutrition. So the medical aid in dying medication permits the individual to take back autonomy and control over how and when. That's it. So that they avoid the fate of that patient from my hospital days who lived for months and months, like, you know, in just extraordinary suffering before her body finally gave up and she was able to pass. So I, you know, physician assisted suicide, if that exists, I know it's not legal anywhere. I would never in a million years take part of it. It is illegal. It is not a thing. But this was appropriate medication for someone who was going to pass away anyway. As Dr. Kligler, I think, really vibrantly put it, someone who dies by suicide, if they don't have a terminal illness, if they hadn't taken that step, the next day they'd be alive, and the next, and the next, and the next, and so forth. My patients in this limited set of circumstances will die of their malnutrition within 6 months. So it's a matter of not punishing them for having the mental illness that they can't eat tacitly by saying you can't have medical aid in dying because really all you have to do is eat. But that is a reductionist view of what eating disorders are that fly in the face of everything we know about the biology and the neurobiology of eating disorders. It's not a disorder where you just have to eat. The act of eating itself is the profound complexity and the barrier. And interestingly, I suspect that this will be a potential subject of a future podcast that you do. Several weeks after my article was published, Canada released information that in 2022, it will be providing medical aid in dying to individuals whose mental illness has been determined to be irremediable. They don't even have a medical cause, just that their mental illness and their attempts at treatment have left them with such a level of suffering that they may receive MAID. So, I mean, that goes way beyond my article and way beyond this disease where they're going to die. Now, how do I try to honor them in their course of dying?
Okay. Yes. And thank you for sharing that too. And I believe it's 2023.
That's right.
That Canada will offer that. And that is certainly a discussion we'll be having in the future. And yeah, it's odd how all of this is kind of unfolding at the same time, right? We kind of stumbled across your article, got in contact with you, and now we're learning about Canada and this law as well, which I think it goes, that's kind of the big piece of all of this. For example, the way the law is written, the individual needs to be mentally capable and have mental, I guess, autonomy and awareness. Something like an eating disorder is considered a mental illness. And I think it's complicated by the comorbidities of something like malnutrition or suicidal ideation. And specifically with the malnutrition, we've mentioned that it does impact the brain. The brain will become malnourished. And my question is, how can we be sure that that person is still mentally competent and capable of making sound decisions, even though we know that physically their brain is malnourished from their disease?
That's such an important question. My experience in the field led me to be totally confident that the individuals I was working with, despite their body distortions and their feelings and fears about food and weight gain, understood the information being presented, were able to think through it rationally, expressed an understanding of alternatives and what the repercussions of their decisions would be, which is sort of the crux of medical legal decision-making evaluations. However, and I think this is ultimately helpful in hindsight, two out of the three had a formal independent decision-making capacity evaluation by an independent psychiatrist during the course of these discussions, because their families asked the same questions. These are relevant questions. And both of them were found without question to possess decision-making capacity in the sense that it is defined. This is an interesting topic, again, because it comes down to how do we view the autonomous rights of somebody who has a mental illness? Are they a lesser human? Are they afforded fewer rights than those who don't happen to have mental illness? Of course, my answer to that is no. And yet we want to be really careful. You know, somebody who has florid psychosis from schizophrenia cannot make a major decision for themselves. They do not possess the ability to hear information, manipulate it, manage it, and come out with a reasonable answer in the throes of psychosis. And when we think about an individual, say, as very often happens, someone with alcohol use disorder comes into the hospital. They have alcoholic hepatitis. So not only may they have cirrhosis long-term, but they have a florid acute liver failure in the moment from their drinking. And they say after 3 days, I want to leave the hospital. And you try and you talk to them and you say, please stay. We can actually turn this around. We can do steroids. We can ease this. You have a very high risk of dying, 50% if you leave the hospital right now. And they say, no, I can't bear this. I'm going to leave. I want to leave the hospital. So you have the team come in to assess their decision-making. You want to make sure they're not in the middle of delirium tremens, that they're completely cognitively capable, that they're not impacted by their liver cirrhosis. And if they show that they are able to understand the ramifications, what we don't ask them is to make decisions we agree with, decisions that are the smartest for their body. And we don't ask them about beliefs that they hold that are otherwise questionable. For instance, we don't ask patients in this situation, do you believe the earth is flat? And if they say, if we did ask them that question and they said yes, which we know patently to be untrue, we would not say, well, now you're not allowed to leave the hospital because you're irrational, because there is a very large population, unfortunately, of people who believe the earth is flat. And yet they are able to buy a car and pay a mortgage and go to work and do all these things. So whether or not someone holds beliefs that are dissimilar to the greater population is not one of the criteria for decision-making. And yet, without doubt, they have a mental illness, and it profoundly impacts how they see food in their body. So even if we came to the point where we say, gosh, for the two women patients I cared for, I would have loved them to be in a program until they fully restored weight, to see, was that going to be the thing that allowed their brain, as I've seen so many times before, to wake up and be like, oh, I can do this. It's not such a big deal anymore. I've got this. Yes, I would have loved it, but they refused. So practically speaking, their family would have had to chain them up, get them on an airplane, bring them to Colorado, which is the only state of 50 that has strong enough mental health laws to place a patient with an eating disorder in treatment against their will. It's the only one of 50. And then they would have had to go only to the one program in Colorado that will actually hold patients down, restrain them, and tube feed them against their will. I mean, up to a point, at a certain point, the staff is traumatized, the patient is horrendously traumatized. There gets to be an endpoint of resistance. But that's the only way that they could have been cared for. And that's presuming that they had the insurance or the self-pay mechanism to pay the $2,000 a day that program costs. So if that would be the only mechanism by which they could have been exposed to the one thing they didn't try, we clearly can't call that the standard of care, you know, and that was just impossible to achieve. So at the point where you've done everything else you possibly can, if this were a child, you would chain them up. You would do anything you can to save them, you know, but at the point at which they've been sick for 2 decades and lost everything that mattered in their life to this illness and couldn't get better, there's a point at which you have to say, I'm here to take care of you as you wish to be cared for.
This is where I still struggle with this whole piece. And I think it does lead, as you mentioned, to that greater question of how we perceive people with mental illness and how we move forward with treating them. As acknowledged in the paper, these individuals, although they claim they do want to live, they still aren't doing everything within their power to get healthy. And I understand, I'm starting to understand more that this is the anorexia nervosa and how it is such a powerful and horrendous disease. But at the same time, I have a hard time accepting that idea that they do have a strong desire to live with the comorbidities that we discussed earlier, the suicidal ideation, the severe depression, combined with the anorexia nervosa. And so with all of that, it seems like in the mental health profession that people like yourself and the therapists are at times the biggest advocate for the parent, for the patient, and even the hope holders, the champion, the one that, you know, they can go to with the hopes that they're going to be there all the way through to do everything to get this person healthy. I guess my question is, what would your response be to somebody asking that you are truly assisting in a suicide or throwing in the towel versus that this is true medical aid in dying?
Yeah. You know, I'll try to see if I can bring more thoughts into it than those that I've shared on this really important question. In the case of individuals who have anorexia and who cannot tolerate either yet more or a complete course of treatment, and they meet all the other criteria that are laid out in the paper, we potentially could liken them to somebody whose genetic makeup is such that when they have cancer and they begin chemo, they get every negative effect there is on the list, and their tumor doesn't respond. So, you know, where 90% of people receiving that chemo don't feel good, but they can tolerate it, this person gets, you know, organ failure and bleeding and all of this stuff, and they have to stop the chemo. They can't tolerate the standard of care physically. And therefore, they don't get the opportunity to have the kind of treatment that others with a similar disease do, because their genetic makeup is such that they cannot tolerate it. And those may come to death earlier, despite not having completed the, you know, 4 different types of chemo and 3 types of radiation that others would try, simply because their body can't do it. I would hold that this very, very rare population with terminal anorexia is similar. They are set up in such a way that while it's not a bleeding complication, it is a psychological complication that they cannot tolerate that which is offered to and benefits others. And ultimately, because there's no platelet test for that, we have to take their narrative at its word. And that's not without every possible effort being made to make it more tolerable. And so this isn't just the patient has a problem situation. We also have to look at the deep indignities and problematic nature of eating disorder care in the United States. It is deeply flawed. It must be improved. One of the major goals of my role as a clinician in writing my book, in lecturing, and doing my patient care is to improve the quality of medical care for individuals with eating disorders around the world. Because there's so few doctors that actually know what happened to bodies and can ameliorate the digestive distress and all of the other things that happen, that patients suffer more than they have to. And then they've become hopeless and feel like, I can't tolerate this. So we have to improve the systems. We have to improve the systems of care. We have to improve how insurance works. Because another thing is that many patients let's say, because they are disabled as a result of their eating disorder, have a governmental insurance that is not taken by any of these programs. It's not a choice then. It's literally they cannot access the care that might make them better. So there are so many pieces that are systemic and that are treatment related that come into this. And in the final analysis, one has to come down to an understanding that there was literally nothing else I could have done, having been in relationship with them, knowing as they were, how loved they were by me and their family and the rest of their team, that we would do anything and make any compromise to allow them to keep trying to fight. When we take into account that the drive to live is extraordinary in humans, people can suffer unspeakably and still cling to life and the desire to be alive. I see this all the time in my patients. People who have a quality of life and who live through physical and emotional indignities that I can't imagine bearing still say, I'm staying alive for my kids. I'm staying alive for my grandkids, for my dog, for my nieces. And they keep fighting. So at the point at which it gets so extreme that that is extinguished, and it's not a momentary point of impulsivity like the tragedy of suicide, but rather a thoughtful, detailed discussion, then they have the right to choose for their bodies.
One of the pieces of the article that I noticed was a characteristic of the individuals, and the article consistently refers to them as being of older age, and i.e. the older age of 30. I feel the general public would consider this as a pretty young age. So I wonder of where the criteria of an older age of 30 came from. And also I wonder what the, is there a criteria for the length of illness or the time spent in treatments? Was that a factor in deciding things like medical aid and dying?
That's such a great question. If the paper had said anybody over the age of 70 who also meets these criteria should be permitted to be, you know, to not be forced into treatment again, everyone would agree. And probably same with 60. By 50, there'd be a few deniers. By 40, there'd be more. And at 30, it's like a lot of people would say, hey, now, 30-year-olds are really young, really young. What are we talking about here? When I think about the patients I've cared for, oftentimes they've been sick since they were 10 years old. So when you think about how it feels to fight, let's say cancer, that these individuals have been in treatment often for 20 or 25 years intermittently. They've been on medications with terrible side effects. They've been pulled out of their lives. They've run through an extraordinary amount of familial finances. They have gone to programs that were terrible and programs that were great, and they've been through the dismay of each time relapsing and not being able to live to a degree that they choose. 20 or 25 years of a fight is a really long time. It's a really long time. And when we know that this isn't theoretical, that in fact, through large studies, 5 to 20% of people with anorexia do die. They are currently, presently, historically dying of this disease. Then it's a denialist perspective to say they're not allowed to, or we can't accept that, because it says, I'm not comfortable with the sadness and thought that a 33-year-old who's been through all this could die. But it's not about me in this situation. It's about them and their lived experience and what they've been through and what they're advocating for their bodies. I've seen patients who've been younger than 30 who've been through the ringer and wish to be done. And I've said, you have to keep fighting. We have to keep fighting together. I cannot support you in any other mode but that of a harm reduction or full recovery modality until you get just a few more years in, because there's no doubt about that this is a disease of despair. plenty of people say, I'd rather die than live this way. But if they're 24 and 25, they have not been exposed to long enough therapy, long enough nutritional therapy, and what we think of in the field as sort of a late maturational bump, where towards their mid to later 20s, a number of patients who had been unable to live in the world have this sort of, oh, wait, I might want to do this. I might want to finish my graduate career. I might want to see that next Star Wars movie come out. I might want to see my niece being born. I might want to get married and have children. And something clicks and they recover. So every effort has to be extinguished to give them that chance. But once they've done that, and you know, if the families don't agree, for instance, then we're going to keep fighting, you know, or we're going to keep talking to the family. But in all of these cases, in two of whose families, a parent was a physician, the family said, I have watched my child fight and suffer like I could never imagine. I am devastated at the prospect of losing them, but I will no longer force them. And I understand they can't survive this.
One of the components of the article was, and as mentioned, was that these people did not technically go through every course of treatment to get healthy. And you mentioned a little bit about psychological, being able to tolerate things psychologically versus physically. You also kind of, I could be wrong, maybe referred to the reason that some of these people weren't able to go through with those other pieces was maybe due to those. Psychological intolerance or physical intolerance. Again, with the people in the article and some of the pieces I hear you saying, things like patients mentioning wishing to be done, or I'd rather die than live with this disease, along with the comorbidities, it keeps bringing back to me that this is very different than medical aid in dying. And I feel that it's dangerous to compare medical aid in dying as well as people with cancer and mental health illnesses. I feel like that's almost comparing apples to oranges in a sense, unless the goal and idea is to destigmatize mental health in the sense that it is similar to a physical disease and such. So I can see where you might be, or where that might be a discussion. One of the pieces related to this is that, for me, I could see how this practice could be applied to people, but I need more reflection, more time to dissect some of this stuff. I have a hard time accepting that this is considered medical aid in dying, especially given the amount of advocacy and work that people put forth to give access to this law for people such as myself with a terminal disease like cancer. Again, one of the biggest pieces to this law of medical aid in dying is mental capacity and sound decision making. And when I hear things like suicide ideation and the severe depression that these people have had in the past, and the fact that AN is a mental health disorder, it's scary, right? It's scary to think how, and then Canada obviously is opening this up. So this is conversation we're going to be having a lot of, I think, in the future coming up. So maybe it does go down to your own personal beliefs. Going back to the age piece, 30s is a younger age. I think we would agree in a sense. You mentioned that some of these people have been dealing with this stuff for decades. I wanted to ask about some of the success stories for people who might be older and experience success from AN. And with that, how can we be so certain that if some of these people from your study had tried something like psilocybin and psilocybin interventions? There's a company in Canada called Wisana, and they focus primarily on psilocybin interventions for depression, PTSD, all sorts
all
of
for
mental
that.
Health
Love
disorders.
It.
Yeah, it's fantastic. But I guess how can we be sure that something like that wouldn't have worked, or even if the person would have, you know, kept enduring treatments? It only takes one individual, right, to make that difference and to make that connection and to maybe save that person from this disease. And for myself, I believe in miracles. I believe in hope. I think that's kind of one of the things that we have as a species is holding on to that hope. So it was very hard for me to think about these people using this medication, in this case, the one person using it, because I thought there were other options. And what about hope? What about that hope and desire to live? And maybe in a year or two, or maybe even if it's 5 years or 10 years, when they're in their 40s, that they finally find that person, and then they can have a successful life for the next 20, 30 years. So I guess ultimately where I'm going with this is the age criteria piece. I feel like that is still such a young age for people moving forward. And with that, can you share about any people who have had success later in life while battling something like anorexic nervosa?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the core of what I do is to be a hope bringer. My physical exam skills are only okay. I'm not super great at knowing the literature, but I'm a really good communicator. And for my entire career in this field, I have dedicated myself to finding the words to make recovery feasible for people who didn't think they could. And I'm proud to say I and many other of my colleagues have 100% helped people experience those miracles. People who come in and won't even talk to me in the first session, 4 years on, are fully recovered and laughing and having a grand time and enjoying their lives. You know, this is the nature. If it weren't like that, it would be hard to do. This is a disease in which you have to hold hope and expertise and deep, profound compassion and real knowledge of what triggers and what ameliorates and the disorder in order to help. And so, yes, I was there. You know, I came on to their teams as a voice of hope and respect and preparation to, you know, be there for them and to make this work. I think it's not unreasonable when you consider those who have any sort of terminal disease, particularly the neurologic diseases, where function diminishes over time to a point of extreme dysfunction, that those patients too, when their function becomes so poor, feel depressed, feel suicidal, not in the sense perhaps of like, I don't want to live. They want to live disease-free, but that living and enduring each day becomes burdensome. And death, while not desired, is also not pushed away. You know, and that's the whole reason why MAID came to be, is because once you know that you have 6 months to live from something, you aren't required to live through each agonizing day of that until the primary disease process takes you, unless you choose to. And so many do. I know that a very few, the small number of people who receive MAID even ever use it. But that is the nature of their suffering too. It's not that we can feel suspicious or sort of stigmatizing of somebody whose suffering has become so intense that they can no longer imagine waking up joyfully. It's that we have to show all the more compassion. They don't deserve to have less autonomy, especially in this case where they were going to die anyway. If I had held the line that, you know, you understandably are grappling with around their age or the fact that they hadn't tried every possible thing that could have helped. Even people with cancer don't try every possible thing that could have helped. That doesn't make them lesser cancer patients. It just means they're deciding that they don't want to do certain things with their bodies, and they're allowed to make those decisions too. But in the final analysis, if I had said, "You're too young, I can't do it. If you're not listening to my words, I'm just not going to be part of this," they would have been abandoned and they would have died painfully or in conflict. I think the key is these individuals were going to die. So how was I going to help support them and their beautiful families through the final days? And one of the ways to know that this is not something that oh gosh, we got it wrong, is that all three of these families and I have stayed in super close touch since then. And each one of them has done the most extraordinary acts of generosity and generativity by putting money and resources and time into helping prevent eating disorders for other people. I mean, each one of them has had an amazing impact already in trying to help other people not suffer the fate that their child did. So they don't feel resentful. I just got a beautiful, beautiful picture from Jessica's mother of the bench that they established in her name with this gorgeous quotation on it. I mean, these are lives celebrated and mourned and grieved, but celebrated. So this was going to happen. It does happen in a very rare number of cases. And for us not to acknowledge that their suffering is real and that their ability to advocate for their bodies is equal to those with other terminal diseases is to unfairly stigmatize them and to prolong suffering.
Just to be sure, and it's something I wanted to clarify, there is no like brain scan or MRI, no, you mentioned blood tests earlier. There's no sort of physical test or anything that can be done to say, yes, this person has anorexia.
Correct.
Okay. And thank you for clarifying that. I do want to be respectful of your time, and this was such an impressive conversation, and you certainly gave me so much to think about. And I think it takes people like us having these really difficult discussions, whether you agree with them or not, to move and advocate and move things forward in a good direction for all people. There's certainly going to be some rocky spots along the road here moving forward, especially as you mentioned with that Canadian legislation being passed moving forward. You might have noticed from listening to some of the pods, I love to send it over to Hasban. He always ends up developing some good questions and has some thoughts throughout. So Has, if you're there and have anything for Dr. G, jump in.
Hi, Dr. G. I just wanted to, I enjoyed the discussion. I think there's going to be a lot more in the future about this, especially with the new law in Canada. And what I want to clarify something real quick. When Andrew asked you about the age of 30 and that being considered older, I believe what you said is that the age of 30 is something that is a time in a person's life where things like having, you know, nieces and nephews, having kids, something clicks at that age. And that's why you guys thought that the age of 30 is like the right age.
Yeah, it's not that 30 is a magical age. It's that individuals with anorexia nervosa can suffer so terribly that they feel they can't keep fighting as of 25. And so interestingly, 30 is the stretch age. 30 is where we say, no, we've got to take every effort to keep you alive longer so that you have every opportunity to realize the joys that life can bring and to find courage to fight this. So for most people, 30 is actually the stretch age, not a young age when it comes to this disease.
Got it. And then you were quoted in the National Post saying that you, and I want to make sure that this is quoted right, that you couldn't imagine endorsing MAID for any other psychiatric condition, though you may reconsider down the road. I just wanted to ask what led to your current stance and what you're looking for that might change your mind.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I was interviewed for that article, I was unaware of the guidelines that were coming out in Canada. I mean, I knew that theoretically they were coming out. I hadn't read the paper yet. I'm not a psychiatrist. I imagine that I need to do more work on understanding that people with primary mental illness with no other medical cause of death could meet criteria to receive medical aid in dying. I can foresee it. I believe in the profoundness of mental suffering. I think that great care has to be made to protect those who are vulnerable in that setting. And I just want to go slowly on it because that would be a real learning edge for me. So I don't think that there would be one particular situation that would push me over. I just have to sort of sit and marinate on it, much like your listeners may have to be like, holy beans, I have to sit and marinate on what I just heard. This really pushes me past what I've thought about before. But the fact that, you know, and I have read through that article and the decision-making process by which they came to the criteria, I find the criteria quite beautiful. The fact that the word narrative is brought in, you know, that the patient's narrative of their life, that takes over from sort of a CAT scan finding or a blood test finding, that the criteria very lovingly say, if side effects aren't too terrible, ... should have been tried. That's so respectful of the lived experience. So I can imagine getting there, but I'm not there yet. And I myself would never, ever get involved in a case like that because I'm an eating disorder specialist and I'm an internist. So that would be well out of my scope of practice.
Got it. And I wanted to clarify, and I know we're going over time, so I'm trying to ask quick, that you guys mentioned psilocybin in your discussion. We didn't really, I guess what I want to ask is, psilocybin is kind of known primarily for having the ability to rewire the brain, which seems to be kind of one of the main, you know, issues here, that no matter what you do, the person's brain is just wired that way. So how effective, if at all, has psilocybin been, and what kind of information is out there about how effective it is?
It's a great question. We don't have any data yet. There are a couple of wonderful researchers looking into both psilocybin and MDMA for those with eating disorders. My great experience is with ketamine and those with eating disorders. And my personal experience of probably sending 35 to 40 patients over the last 6 years to either intravenous or intranasal ketamine in the course of their eating disorder work is that it has zero effect on the eating disorder whatsoever. And I don't expect it to, because the literature doesn't indicate that it would. What it does is it can radically decrease comorbid primary psychiatric symptoms, severe depression, suicidality, PTSD primarily, that get in the way of the eating disorder work. So if you have such a terrible trauma history and PTSD from it, that every time you begin to re-nourish your body, your brain warms up, your PTSD goes haywire, and you're so physically reactive that you're in constant physical symptoms and torment, going through ketamine can cool that down, so that you can tolerate the process of having a brain that's warmed up and a body that's returning perhaps to the body in which a sexual trauma occurred. These are really real important things. I also use prazosin, for instance, the old blood pressure medicine, for PTSD symptoms that are felt to be anxiety. So anytime I can take the edge off or ameliorate other features that are in the way of the primary recovery, I advocate for it.
Got it. Okay. So yeah, I'm looking forward to the day when there's some information about psilocybin. This seems like theoretically to the layman like me, there would be a lot of potential. That's all I got. I really enjoyed your guys' conversation. And like I said, I think it's going to be one of many.
Thank you so much for your thoughtful questions.
Yeah. Thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks, Hazvan. Those are good. And I just, from my own personal experience and use, yes, I'm a big believer in the psilocybin. I do think that in once given access, you know, by people like yourself, if that was something that drew your interest or other doctors, when given permission by, you know, the government to be able to use this for medical purposes, I mean, I firmly believe it's going to be a game changer.
Me too.
It's going to take time, you know, 20, 30, 50 years. But I think that at the end of the day, we're going to see how we're going to look back and think, wow, we wasted a lot of time with things like pharmaceuticals and these interventions when it was all right here the whole time.
I couldn't agree.
But I will say with that, I don't think it's for everybody, right? You know, different strokes for different folks, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, people respond differently to all sorts of treatments, and that's not something I would recommend for everybody. But Doc, I do want to ask, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners to close out on, whether it's any advice or, you know, advice regarding an eating disorder or mental health or anything from this discussion that you need to clarify? We like to give the guests a chance at the end here to just kind of close things out.
Thank you.
Dr. G, I also kind of to piggyback off that, I know that you guys have like a definite, you guys have a way of approaching the word diet and like Weight Watchers. I thought maybe it would be nice for people to know about maybe what the right way to talk about that or not talk about that maybe.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll address that one first and then the final set of thoughts second. Our society's obsession with thinness equaling health, virtuosity, willpower is deeply harmful. It places a hierarchy of bodies that are really not attainable for some people, perhaps based on medication or genetics. And it's the last place where open stigma is still thought to be acceptable across both political parties. Both political parties broadly still think you can make fun of fat people and it's okay. It's super harmful. And what I encourage everyone to do, and I have a lot of podcasts on this on our website, is to begin accepting body diversity, encourage people to eat abundantly and adequately throughout the day and get movement in their body that honors what they want to and can do with their bodies, each one to their own goals and values, and to recognize that diet culture has caused vastly more harm than it has good, because as long as doctors have been recommending diets, the populace has continued to get fatter. And biologically, there's a lot of reasons why that is so. It reduces our metabolism. It puts our evolutionary brains into a body conservancy space, because that's how we survived through evolution when we didn't have enough food to eat, was to maintain weight, gain more after we didn't have enough to survive the next famine. So to the extent possible, people can improve the overall pollution of diet culture by no longer talking negatively or positively about their bodies in public spaces, by not putting down people who have different bodies, certainly not larger bodies, and by recognizing that the best health is going to be found not only through overhauling the fundamental policies of the way that people get food and healthcare and safe access to open space in our country, but also through no longer creating a hierarchy of bodies in which one limited type gets all the goodies. Beyond that, my last thing that I want to leave people with is that eating disorders can be completely curable, and that anyone who wants to keep trying recovery, no matter how much money has been spent, no matter how many years, no matter how much suffering, no matter how many bridges burned, should be encouraged to and supported in finding whatever level of recovery they can accept. So that is the overarching message of this. I never want people to think that my main practice is the three rare patients for whom I wrote this article as a piece of advocacy and love to speak to other families who are in a similar situation. The rest of the population, let's go, let's do this.
This was a wonderful discussion here, Doc. You gave us a lot to think about, certainly, and I think our listeners as well. And again, it takes people like you and I to have these discussions and take these risks and publish these articles in order to get the ball rolling and make change and advocate for, you know, the people we care about. So I really commend you for being such a, you know, advocate for your patients. And I don't know how I feel yet about this approach and your approach. Again, this discussion has given me a lot to think about, but I think that if anything, it does give the opportunity to learn from this, grow from this, and, you know, get better from this as well. So I appreciate that. And I just really appreciate you taking the time to sit down and talk with us. We know you're a super busy person and you're helping a lot of other people. So to take the time out of your busy day is very thoughtful. We appreciate that.
No, I'm so appreciative for your sophisticated and compassionate and thoughtful questions that move the dialogue forward without a question.
Yeah. And again, this has given, I think, all of us a lot to think about. And there's some really deep questions that are underlying here that I think are more at, you know, kind of at stake versus some of the, you know, deeper than this article. There's a lot more here. So a lot to think about. Really appreciate your time, Dr. Jennifer Gaudiani. Thank you so much. And I'm sure we'll be in touch in the future. We'd love to reach out, maybe have some more discussions moving forward, especially as some of these things develop here in the States and in Canada as well.
Sounds great. Thank you.
All right. Have a great day, Doc. We appreciate it.